This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. Pianist, composer, bandleader Overton Berry's career in Seattle music goes back more than 50 years. He played at clubs around the 1962 World's Fair. He performed during the Wheatles Groove Seattle funk explosion during the 70s. And ever since, he's maintained an active performing career. Overton Berry, it's a really great pleasure to have you with us today.
It's good to be here. Boy, that's a lot of stuff you just read off.
Well, we're going to hear some more about it. I mean, let's start with your childhood. Where did you grow up and what was your family like? Was it a musical family?
I was born in Houston and we moved here when I was probably about 10 or 11 years old. I had a cousin who played trombone with Count Basie and I think later on with the Ray Charles Orchestra. And he advised my mother, who was a very mean lady, to start me off on piano because he said he's going to learn music. And if he wants to switch to any other instrument, he can. So I started off studying when I was like 4.5, 5 years old. But then, of course, it was all classical music, which is I love now. But at the time, when I was 12 years old and here, and she sent me to Cornish, and I had a priest for a teacher, and I thought, I'm not that bad. I've got to have a priest. But he was really a great guy and showed me a lot of stuff. In fact, he showed me my first boogie-woogie line in I don't know, something by Bach or something like that. But when I was 12, I was playing some music for my friends, and they said, well, that's great. Do you know any songs? And at that point, I said, I quit. That's it, you know. And my mother was crafty. She waited about a year, year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then she said that she wanted to take piano lessons from this guy who taught pop music and jazz stuff. And I should have known something was coming down the line because the woman was 300 years old at least. And she said she wanted me to take a couple of lessons first. And I did. I took for about 3 or 4 years. She never took one lesson from the guy. But I studied with him, and that was sort of the introduction into the, I'll say more of the pop, the courting and the improvising field. And that was really great because I met a lot of musicians.
Yeah. How old were you about that time?
I was probably 13.
There was a thriving music scene, the Jackson Street scene, which has been written about. Were you part of that, or was that before your time?
Not at that particular time. Later,
yeah.
When I had joined the Black Local Musicians Union, 493, I had joined that. Had started working with guys like Floyd Stanifer and Bob Marshall and people like that, playing primarily dances and you know, social functions. But that club had a thriving jam session thing going on Friday nights and Saturday nights and all night long. I mean, it was really great. And it was the kind of place where musicians, not just Black musicians, but white musicians, could come and jam. And this was, I think this was the beginning of that part of my education musically, that I could listen to these guys. And of course, I didn't understand what they were doing, but it was very important to just be in that scene and breathe in that atmosphere, especially for a young guy. And so when I was going to Garfield, and when I was about 16, I graduated. But what I did was I put together, at that time I had heard George Shearing, and that just blew me away. Then I started listening to guys like Oscar Peterson and Lenny Tristano and people like that. And I put together a trio, piano, bass, and guitar, kind of fashioned after the Oscar Peterson and Nat King Cole trio sounded early days. And we played a lot of USO shows because this was the period. And so we would play a lot of military bases. We were part of a USO troop and we would play those places and working with singers and things like that.
This would have been like 1950s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great.
It's been, yeah, 52, 53, 54, right in there.
So 1962, it's kind of Seattle's arrival on the world stage with the World's Fair, a lot of music going on both at the fair and, as I understand it, outside the fair too.
Oh, definitely, definitely. It was incredible. In terms of particularly the jazz scene, there was the opening of a place called the Penthouse, and here were people that you would only see in things like Jazz at the Philharmonic in a concert format. But here they were playing in clubs, you know, 5-6 nights a week. And we had a coffee house called the House of Entertainment. So because it was a coffee house, we could run late hours. And so we would have all these guys coming in and sitting in, and it was just incredible. An incredible scene, not just there, but across the board in Seattle, especially for music. I mean, I remember one night, one of the guys came in from Stan Kenton's band, and he wanted to play Once I Had a Secret Love. And we played a bunch of songs, and he said, "Are you going to let me sit in?" I said, "Oh, my God, yeah." And so he sat in. Well, by the end of that week, each night he would bring in another guy from the Kenton band. And by the end of the night, these guys were all over the room. I mean, guys in trombones standing up playing in the back of the room. But it was that kind of musical situation during that period.
Could you share maybe some music that you would have played around that time?
Sure. Not going to play Secret Love, no. Let's see.
Overton Barry performing in the KUOW studios. Did I hear a little quote from T for Two in there?
Yeah.
Shortly after the World's Fair, it's 1964, the British invasion, the Beatles arrived and really caused a sea change in popular music all across the country. How was that felt here in Seattle?
I think it opened up a lot of avenues for being able to express yourself musically differently. Instead of just having your blues band, your jazz band, you got a chance to kind of explore other avenues of songs that I remember a student of mine came, and at first when the Beatles hit the scene, I was not too impressed with the stuff I heard on the radio, right? And I had a student who wanted to record, and he brought me this song. And it was the Beatles, yesterday. And I went, where'd you get this? And he said, it's a Beatles song. And I said, you're kidding me. And he went, no. And so then, and I think that was one of the things that happened, not only in my mind, but in the minds of a lot of people. It was like, we can do things with this. There was a label called CTI, Creed Taylor. Yeah. And one of the things he did was he got these arrangers like Bob James and Don Sebesky, and he used all these jazz musicians, and but he would do, you know, Beatle tunes like Day in the Life with Wes Montgomery. And it wasn't quite the purest thing, but it also gave these guys a whole new opportunity for expression, using different material. Not that the jazz charts written by Miles and people like that weren't great. It was that all of a sudden you expanded the whole thing. And I think it opened the avenue for a lot of non-traditional stuff that you had to play or could play. You could interpret some of their material. And some of the artists that did that were extremely sensitive. They caught the essence of what, because it was good music. You know, it didn't matter. And you know, the Beatles, one of the things I credit them for mostly is they recognized the artistry of the old blues and street musicians of the U.S. and said so. And all of a sudden, people in this country went, what? What do you mean he's playing on the corner down here? You know, let's go down there and listen to him. They started listening to you know, the guys like B.B. or King. There's so many more. Lightnin' Hopkins.
Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah, Howlin' Wolf. Yeah, I mean, suddenly these guys were elevated. Their music and themselves were elevated to a stage that greater exposure, much greater exposure.
So interesting to like British musicians to turn Americans on to what was their own music.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's jump forward in time. It's the late 60s. We're moving into the 70s. And there was this kind of a funk explosion in Seattle of all these bands that were in some quarters largely forgotten until Light in the Attic Records came out with a collection called Weedle's Groove.
Yeah.
And a lot of us who'd lived here for a while went, oh, there was this really interesting thing happening back then. And some of your songs are included on that. Tell us a little bit about what that era was like when funk and soul kind of rose up like that.
It was a really interesting period because the soul explosion in the country, the R&B explosion in the country was massive then. And so groups got together in Seattle. And Seattle has always been a great place for getting things together. And there became a Seattle kind of a sound, you know, Cold Bolden together. I mean, Family Affair. These groups were very original, but they were taking the essence of what was going on nationally and exploding it. And suddenly people began to realize, my God, we got some great musicians here. We got some great bands here. And it was interesting to me that years later that Light in the Attic picked up on and decided to go with that format, go and revive it. And it was some of the performances, and I was only a small part of this whole thing, but some of the performances were interesting because the audiences were made up of young people who were not even around during that period, but who loved that music. And it was very exuberant. It was very live. There was a lot of feeling in it. And the artists that were performing it, you know, were incredible musicians, incredible artists in their own right. And they had a joy in playing this music. There was a joy there. And I think that the audience caught on to that thing a lot.
Was that a comfortable fit for you? You were kind of coming from, a jazz background.
Yeah, it was comfortable because one of the things that happened for me in the 69, I started working at a place called the Doubletree Inn in South Center. And one of the things that was interesting to me is that I could play anything that was real to me. You know, I could. In fact, one of the things we used to do we would do things like Here, There, and Everywhere by the Beatles. We would do things like Jesus Christ Superstar, a medley of things from there, and we could do sambas, but we could also do some jazz charts. One of the things I learned about George Shearing was his mastery of programming. He would play a place in Beverly Hills or Hollywood, like the Crescendo Room, and he would play something like Body and Soul and Stardust, and then he would follow that with a Miles Davis tune. Well, the people who never even heard of Miles Davis would go, "That's a really nice song. And who's this Miles Davis fella?" You know, and so he had a way of doing that. And that became kind of an MO for me, was that I could do all these things that I felt good about doing. And as long as I programmed them right in terms of placing them in the night, people would go, "Well, that's good." One night we were getting ready to do a recording. The Doubletree and management wanted to do a recording. And so we did two or three live nights with John Lewis, who had a group of talent in town at the time.
He John was Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet.
No, no, not John, John Lewis. Okay. Johnny Lewis of Seattle.
Okay.
And he recorded us. Well, one night during this recording thing, we did recorded three or four nights, this gentleman from the audience walked up and he said, "Can you play Hey Jude?" And I said, "I don't know it." And Chuck Metcalf is a great bassist and dear friend. He said, "Oh, yeah, we can do it." And I said, "Chuck, I don't know it." And he said, "No, we're just going to do the ending." And believe me, that started the whole saga. I think on my epitaph they're going to put "Here Lies Hey Jude Forever." But anyway, so he taught me the ending, just like that. It was very simple chords and very simple line. And we started developing it. Well, the manager of the Doubletree Inn walked in during the scene, and he said, "I like it." And I said, "Don, it's only the ending." And he said, "No, I want to record it just like that." And thus started the whole thing. And that's what they use in Wheatley's Groove.
And that was a big song for you, too.
It was. It's so funny because I never did learn the whole song.
Could we hear the part that you did learn?
Okay.
Overton Barry, Hey Jude. You're listening to him. He's here in the performance studio of KUOW, and we're talking about his long career in music, which really parallels a lot of Seattle music history. You know, you mentioned that you went to Garfield High School, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things about music in Seattle over the last 10, 15 years has been the arrival of jazz bands at the high schools in Seattle. Clarence Acocks and others have really nourished some award-winning jazz bands here. Mm-hmm. What's that done for the music scene?
I think it, you know, it's really funny because here you've got these bands playing these tremendous, you know, Duke Ellington, Count Basie arrangements, and you've got people like Clarence Acocks who are very instrumental in guiding these students, not just to play the notes, but to get the essence of it, you know, and of course they go back and compete with bands from all around the country, which is also an interesting phenomenon, the fact that there are so many jazz bands and orchestras in high schools and colleges too, all around the country, that are picking up these kind of it's so funny because when you consider that in the 40s and the 50s, jazz music was not considered to be the acceptable mode of music in for the U.S. And it wasn't until the Europeans started going, oh, well, that's good stuff, you know, and like I say, other artists started recognizing it, because it was a very small cult kind of a thing in terms of its appeal. But now, it's different, and when you have these high school students playing these things with great depth. I remember when they opened the and dedicated the Quincy Jones thing at Garfield. I remember I was there and I was watching Clarence's band, his high school band, and I've told him later. I said, "My God, it's like a football team. You got people coming off the benches and jumping up there and playing, gals playing drums and guys playing horns." And I said, it's like watching some kind of NFL team.
We should explain. It's like watching three bands because they'll switch out the players over the course of the song. So you'll see three drummers and four bass players.
Yeah, it's incredible. But what an encouraging thing that is. And Clarence over the years has introduced me to other high school band directors, you know, from I think Mercer Island, or I'm not sure exactly where, but he's introduced me to them, and they're all dedicated to this thing, and the students seem to be dedicated as well. And I think that's done a lot for the older musicians being able to see that the stuff that they've been doing is appreciated.
You know, you mentioned how the Beatles and the rock revolution kind of gave some inspiration, mm-hmm. and how the funk music mm-hmm. kind of combined with jazz in some interesting ways. What about the present? I mean, rap music and mm-hmm. is sort of the music of the day. Do you think that's feeding into anything that you can relate
to? Well, it's interesting because you had the rap scene was just really just about the words and lyrics and the rhythm and that sort of thing, and rhythmic things going on that were interesting. Then you started getting guys putting music to this phenomena that was going on. For example, there is an incredible album that Quincy Jones did called Back on the Block.
That's right.
And he's got these rappers in the beginning of the thing, and of course and it's an incredible album, recording, because it's got Ray Charles and all kinds of other, Shaka Khan and people like that in it. But I remember one of my sons exposed me to a thing called, believe it or not, it was Tupac, and it was Take These Broken Wings Until the End of Time. And here is you know, singers from Quincy's thing and from a group called Guy. They're singing this old song, Take These Broken Wings. And I can't remember the pop group that did that. But they're doing it next to his rap thing, which comes out incredibly well, mm-hmm. incredibly well. So I think what you're always going to have is kind of an amalgamation of what is currently modern in rap, or whether it's grunge or whatever. you're going to always have a merger kind of some things, because some of these, you got to remember, these people have listened to other stuff a long time. They've developed their own particular style and their own thing, but they've been listening to it. And to me, that's what feeds your soul. That's what feeds your musical being, is what you have listened to. You don't necessarily can identify the thing that you're doing with what you listened to at a particular time, but it's all in there, and it's all being mixed up. I always like to tell this story. I was in the old 493 Union Hall practicing one day, and I was really young and just trying to get all my little technical chops together and stuff. And there was an old guy standing there watching me. And by old guy, he was probably about 35, which is really young to me now. But he listened to me probably as long as he could. And then he said to me, "Hey, kid, do you know what's the most important thing about playing music?" And of course, young, I'm irritated. How dare he interrupt me? But it's okay. And I said, yeah. You know, your hands, your chops, your fingers, your technique, and da 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 da. And he said, "No." And I said, "What do you mean, no? I mean, come on." And he said, "No, listening is the most important thing in music." And I listened. And he said, and this was where he got me. He said, "I didn't say hearing. I said listening." And I'll never forget that. This was probably one of the greatest musical lessons I ever had. I said, "What's the difference?" And he said, "You hear with your ears. You listen with your whole being." And as he left the room, because now the rehearsal, the practice is over, I got to think about this and deal with this thing. He said, "By the way, kid, it's also the most important thing in life, and it's a skill you'll be working on all your life."
Wow, what a great message.
Yeah, I wherever he is, I'd like to thank him.
At this point, you're an accomplished musician. You've had decades of experience. Are there things that you still aspire to be able to do in your art, in your craft, on the piano or musically? Is there still another horizon you'd like to get to?
Oh yeah, there's always elements that you perceive of and are inspired to do. It's a matter of, again, taking it in and allowing you really start to learn to allow the music to happen, to let it come through you, let it direct itself, whether you're performing or whether you're recording or whether you're even just planning to what you want to do. You begin to realize that, okay, kid, get out of the way, mm-hmm. get out of the way, and start accessing this entire music feel. One of the things to me is about appreciation. I mean, especially every pianist in Seattle is a teacher of mine. I'm inspired by them. I listen to them. It isn't so much, and I've had some of the guys show me particular exercises and things to do, and but it's more like allowing that inspiration to guide you into what you want to do. And of late, I've been working with a couple of horn players, and I've worked with some very fine vocalists over the years. And you learn to become sensitive to the other artists and what they do, what they can bring to it, so that it's not just a matter of you directing everything. It's a matter of you sort of setting the playing field. You know, and allowing each player to do it, because everything that you do, I do a lot of work with just bassists, and I will show them the arrangement and the format and the layout, but every one of them will do something a little different that inspires me to do something a little different, so that it's never stagnant. It's always got to be alive.
Well, we don't have someone playing with you to inspire you today, but is there a piece of music that maybe you're working on, or you've just kind of gotten to the point that you're happy with that you could play for us?
Yeah, there's a. I was working in Tokyo in Japan, And there was a gentleman from the States who would come in, and he would never request a song by title. He would give me a picture, and he would always say, make me up a song for it. And, I remember the first one. He said, Overton, you're a 12-year-old boy, and you want to tell your father you love him. Make me a song. And it was just an interesting, a whole nother little twist to approach it. And anyway, he would do this all the time. But the last time he came in with his wife, and it was their 11th wedding anniversary. And so he asked me to make up a song for their thing. And so it was, again, it was accessing something, not directing something, that led me to a song called 11 is Forever.
Really nice, Overton.
Thank you.
I one final question for you today. You've seen so much of Seattle music history in the course of your career here. How would you compare what it's like today for a working musician like yourself to the way it's been in the past? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten harder? Where would you place us now in 2014?
I think the key word here is it's gotten different.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember guys back in the 50s talking about how it had changed from the 40s. And I can remember in the 60s and 70s guys talking about how it had changed from it is different. It is different. There are not as many lounges that perform music anymore like there used to be. And a lot has to do with the laws. A lot has to do with the insurance rates on clubs. And the cost in general of doing business in a musical entertainment environment. Seattle has always been a great concert city, and I think that has kind of taken over in the past few years. Whereas before it was pretty much live music, piano bars, and little duos and trios and quartets working in places. I don't think you have that as much anymore. But I think it's mainly that it's different. You have, all of a sudden, you've gotten the last 10, 15 years, casinos springing up with entertainment venues. So some of the acts that used to be mainline concert acts are now playing the casinos. And I think it's always going to be different. I think it's always going to change because that's the nature of not only music, but the nature of the music industry. There's always going to be, you know, and it's so funny because in some ways things never change. You know, we were talking about rap and we're talking about this kind of thing. Well, you had guys like James Brown way back when doing rap. You know, you had guys like Michael Jackson doing the Moonwalk. Well, you had James Brown doing that stuff, you know, 20 years earlier. So, I mean, things will adapt. Things will keep moving.
Overton Berry, it's been a great pleasure to have you with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW.